Thank you, Don. My name's Ralph. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here, have a chance to be a part of this wonderful Mont Eagle convention you have here. It's my first one. It will not be my last one. And I know why you like it. It's just such a spiritual place. And everybody, like Garner said last night, everybody feels like family here. And it's a different thing. And I'd like to take time to thank you, Milton, for inviting me. And another thing I'd like to thank, I want to thank all these old-timers that are here. I mean, it's a big deal. I've never seen this many old-timers in a meeting at the same time. And thank God you were here when I got here. Thank God you were here when I got here. Because my sponsor, he told me I had 18 years when I came in here. And I didn't believe him, you know. It took me about a year. I figured he would, you know, tell me that. And he's really drinking on the side a little bit, you know. Took me a while to realize that he really had such a long-term sobriety, 18 years. You know, now these guys got 58, 50, 47, my goodness. But another old-timer that I would like to tell y'all about is a guy named Bill Carroll. He's passed away now. And Bill, and when I went to AA, he was like the doorman. He was the sergeant of arms. He stood right there at the door, and he checked out everybody that came in. He'd taken notes. And Bill was the kind of guy, he just had this, if some of you guys ever been to Greenville, you would have met Bill Carroll. But we had a speaker one night from the north, and this guy came down, he told Bill, he said, Bill, how long do I talk here? Some places I go, it's 2 hours, some an hour and a half, maybe an hour. I've been to some just 30 minutes. How long do you talk here? And he said, well, here, down here in the south, we just real loose about everything. We want you to talk and get it all off your chest. Don't leave nothing out. Of course, our meeting's at 8 o'clock at night. He said, but at 9 o'clock, we leave it. So my battery in my watch went out, but I got Don let me borrow his up here, so I'm gonna kind of put it up here as 9:45, and I'm up here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Well, I grew up in a small town in Leland, Mississippi. I came from an alcoholic home. Don told a little of it. My daddy was an alcoholic. He was a binge drinker. He came to his first meeting in 1951. He would have been, I think, about your age, Don, maybe 86, had he lived. But he was my hero. He only got drunk maybe once or twice, you know, he'd go a year and he'd get drunk, and it seemed like it was always Christmas. And it always made me really sad to see him getting drunk. And in my later years, my mother also became an alcoholic in my teenage years. But my father, he was a great civic leader. He was on the board of aldermen in our town. He was on numerous bank boards, and he was even a board of regents here at the University, the University of the South here in Suwanee. And when I would come in and see him guzzle down a fifth of vodka and sit there and look at him sitting in a chair, this great metamorphosis would take place. His facial figures would just fall, And he would he'd start crying, and he would slobber on himself, and had no resemblance of my father whatsoever. And it would always upset me. It always scare me. It would make me so sad to see him this way. And every time he drank, he would have to be, after a few days of this drinking, because he's just chugging stuff. I mean, it's crazy. And we'd have to send him off to these drying out places in those days. There weren't any treatment centers I knew about, but there was a couple of places where they let you go and just let you give you a drink when you got there, you know, and taper you off. And sometimes he'd come back and get drunk again and go back. And it was just this crazy time. And but I had the greatest respect for him when he was sober. And I loved him, and I always wanted his approval. And I tried desperately to get his approval all my life, and I always felt like I had failed. And my brother and I would have to take the responsibility to get him off to some of these places sometimes, and he'd be screaming and crying and hollering when they try to get him in the car, and all this emotional commotion going on and begging us for a drink and don't send me away, you know. I love y'all, please don't send me, you know. And it was a sad time to me. I don't know how other people react to it. I always cried when I saw him like that. And later in my life, I went up here to the Suwannee to prep school, this little, when I was in ninth grade, went to the Suwannee Military Academy here in Suwannee. And all the older guys that were there, they would talk about when they got out for the holidays or leave of some sort, they were going to get drunk. They were going to go home, they were going to raise cane, have a good time, just get drunk all the whole time while they were gone. So I thought that sounded like what you're supposed to do. That's what those guys were doing. So I set out to do the same thing. When I got home, I started drinking, got drunk. Generally, bad things would happen to me, but nothing too terrible at that time. The main thing was I related this to having fun. And I did pretty good in high school. I was a decent athlete. I was a good athlete. And I was an okay student. And I felt as though I might have achieved some of my goals of getting my father's approval here in at Suwannee at the military school. But when I got into the University of the South here at Suwannee, it was free range. I'm out of the military, and alcohol was plentiful. Every fraternity house, every Saturday night, you could go to any fraternity you wanted, they got several kegs, they're drinking beer and drinking whiskey. It was party all the time. And also at this time at the university, this was like the late 60s, early 70s, there was lots of drugs there and I sort of had a mixture of these things. And it was at this time that I had my first blackout. I remember waking up, I didn't even know what bed I was in or what dormitory I was in. I got up, I finally got outside, looked around, couldn't find my car. Didn't know where my car was. I was going around asking everybody I saw, have y'all seen my car? Have you seen my car? Y'all, what happened? What happened to last night? And I had no memory whatsoever. And it's also one little story I'd have to tell you. One of the reasons I stayed on the mountain was because my girlfriend lived up here, and her father was a professor at the university. And he was a good friend of my father's. He was an older man. He taught my father when my father was at the university. So my father had an approval of this relationship. That was sort of good. I was in love. And as most high school romances do, we broke up. Well, most people, they get over these kind of things in a few weeks, a few months. But an alcoholic, he obsesses and obsesses and drinks and thinks about it. Got to drink and think about it and work this thing out for like 10 years. I'm still hung up. Why wasn't I good enough? Oh, maybe one day she'll come back and I take another drink. And so this is my life. I'm just obsessed. And it wasn't just that obsession. And anything I did, it was this obsession. And as I went on through my college years there, I continued to drink. And after this one thing is particularly important about this relationship. I think that was the first time I ever drank to kill the pain. Most of the time I think I was drinking, I had this idea I was having fun. I was probably killing pain anyway. A lot of the stuff I had down inside me, the fears and the lack of self-esteem, I always had this lack of confidence in myself. And I went back to, when I did a four step, I could remember going back to the fourth grade and feeling this sense of not fitting in, the sense of being, Garner said it, less than everybody. I never felt that I measured up. And this was a big deal. And this sort of, when I broke with this girl, I felt that sense. I had failed again, even in my father's eyes, to a sense, the way I would think about it. And I continued to drink and medicate and take all the drugs and alcohol till I was just a basket case. And I was failing, and this was an embarrassment, I'm sure, to my father. He being on the Board of Regents of this university, his son's up here, and he's drunk all the time, and he's flunking out of school. And so before I flunked out, I quit school. I could always say I quit school. I didn't flunk out of school. Anyway, I came home, and my mother wanted me to see a psychiatrist. She thought that there was some psychiatrist they knew in Memphis, and they wanted me to go talk to this man. Well, of course, when I got home, my daddy was drunk. He had been drunk from the time he heard I was coming home, I guess. I don't know why he got drunk, but to me, it was my fault. He got drunk because I had failed. And this kind of emotional place I was at this time, it was just it was hard to take. It was hard to take to see him in this shape and thinking I caused it. And I wasn't strong enough to go back to school. I had been drinking and drugging too long. So my mother wanted me to see a psychiatrist, so I did. And I went to this man, and he told me something that I didn't know. I had a lack of self-esteem, and I had no confidence in myself. I said, well, really? So he wanted me to read all these books. He gave me these books to read, and then he told me, he even wanted me to work out with weights and do exercises and do something that would give me self-esteem and feel better about myself. So I set off on this idea, but I'm going to go home and get drunk anyway. So, it's not too easy to lift weights when you're drunk. I wanted to do something. I was there, home. All my friends were somewhere else. And I asked my daddy, could I come back and work on the farm? He had a farm. That's what we did. He was reluctant to do so, and I guess through my mother's persuasion, intervention there, he let me come work on the farm. And I had it in my mind, I'm going to work as hard as anybody ever worked I'm going to show him I can do something. I'm going to do good down here. I'm going to give it my best. And I did. I tried hard. I did work hard. But every afternoon, there was a guy, one of the people there that worked for my father. He and I would go off in this little old house back in the woods we had. And we'd take some straight shots of wild turkey. And, I mean, that's really the way I drank. That's the way I enjoy drinking. I like to drink it straight. I like to drink out the neck of the bottle. Of course, I didn't want anybody to see me drink out the neck of the bottle, so you always see me with a Budweiser in my hand, but I'm nipping all the time, you know. And I got to where I was about, I guess I was about 22 years old right now, and I'm carrying around half pints and pints of liquor in my truck and my glove compartment, you know, and nipping most of the time. And I try to do that. I try to make it through the day of work before I did that, but it was a time of life where all my friends had were still in school. Some might have gotten married, a few may have got jobs and were working. And I really didn't have any friends there, and I was kind of lonesome. And there's this one guy that I knew that was working there. He knew my wife and introduced me to her, and so we start dating. And I guess I don't know. Sometime later, we decided to get married. Well, I thought this was going to be the answer. You know, I thought, well, this is going to settle me down. I'm going to raise a family. I'm gonna stop all this crazy behavior. I'm gonna have to do something in my life, and this will help it. Well, I don't really think she knew what she had married, because it wasn't long after we got into marriage, all the fights started. Wanted to know why I didn't come home. Where was I? Why didn't I call? Why do you have to come home every night, 10, 11 o'clock? You didn't call, and you're drunk all the time, you know, and it's always the same kind of thing, just the fighting over drinking. And I'd come home. We had, a couple of years later, we had a child, and as he was growing up, I remember coming in one night, and the door was locked, and I tried to get in, and I broke the door in, and I fell in the house and knocked over a lamp. I cut my head. I fell out on the floor, and I was bleeding, and my son came right in looking at me. He said, "Mama, Mama, Daddy's dead." And I was just happy days. I started drinking to have fun. It wasn't so much fun anymore. And I came home one day. We were working on the farm. My brother was down there working with us. And it rained that day. On the farm, we took off. We said, "Well, you know, it didn't rain up where we live. Go play a little golf." So we took off, played golf, and sure enough, about 3:30, 4 o'clock that afternoon, we got rained out and came in. And when I got, we got over to a friend's house. We were sitting over at a friend's house, and this man that I knew that was a friend of the family's, I guess he found out where we were. He came over there where we were, and he looked at me, and I could tell he didn't look just like his old self. He was kind of had this distraught look in his face. And he said, "I got terrible news for you boys." He said, "Your father's been killed in an automobile accident." And boy, I mean, it was like the shock of my life. I think from that point, I just ceased to care. I didn't try to have any... What little efforts I ever made to get sober or anything, I just didn't try anymore. I just drank. I drank. The pain was too bad. I was drinking all the time. I'd drink in the morning. And I wasn't doing so well on the farm anymore. We were getting in a lot of debt. And some of it, I'd try to stay sober through the real important times when we were planting and harvesting and fertilizing and this thing, and then I'd, you know, as soon as we got things half laid by, I'd be in it. I'd be in it all day and all night. And the problems I was having with my wife were just unbelievable. I mean, she had moved out. She'd moved back to her family. She'd be gone a week or two. I'd try my best to get sober and beg her to come back. She'd come back, and then it'd happen again. And one time during this time, I was watching television, and I saw this guy, this commercial on television about this guy that had this hacking cough. And this wife of his was over here, and she'd drunk some kind of funny-looking cough medicine. But this guy had drank NyQuil cough medicine, and he was out cold. I thought, well, that's the kind of guy I want to be. And I got this idea. I said, you know, if I could drink NyQuil and stay asleep long enough, I could get sober. I said, you know, I think I just stay asleep for a day, maybe days, and wake. When I finally got up, I'd be sober. It's better than nipping on that vodka every morning I wake up. And I thought about that. I said, I think I'm going to do this. Well, I'd gone up there to this little, like, 7-Eleven convenience store there, and I'd seen some NyQuil in that store before, and I walked in. And the lady was there at the counter there, and to this day, I've never seen these bottles before. But there were these economy-sized family NyQuil bottles. Hey, about that tall. And I walked up to the lady, and I said, I'd like to have four of those bottles. And she looked at me like I must be crazy, and I got the bottles. I went home, and I set out to do my little Rip Van Winkle sleeping trick. So, I was kind of getting a little wear with this NyQuil. You know, I wasn't drinking as much. Of course, it's stuff 50 proof. I never even thought about that. But I was drinking NyQuil and trying to not drink as much vodka in the morning, and I was doing a lot of sleeping. And, of course, I'm not going to work so much anymore either. But I guess about 3 weeks had passed, and some time passed, and I said, well, I think I'll go back in and get some more of that NyQuil. And I walked to the same place. I walked in there. I said, ma'am, I have four bottles of NyQuil. And she looked at me, and she said, you stays with a cold, don't you? I said, I sure do. And my whole family's sick. We all sick at my house. Well, I was so embarrassed, I walked back out of that place, and I ain't never going in that place again. I'm going over here to Greenville to get my NyQuil. I'm going over here to Indianola to get my, I might go to Memphis to get my NyQuil, but I ain't going back in that place no more. No. Well, some point, somewhere down the road, I got me a DUI and got thrown in jail. And I don't know, it was sort of the first time in jail, and sort of a wake-up call in a way. The wake-up call was, don't get drunk driving on the highway. That's what I thought. And so I did try to control that part of it, because in those days, you get three or four of these things, you could go to prison. And so I didn't quite drink as much of that, driving and drinking anymore. So, but I was still doing my NyQuil. And I at this time, I'd gotten drunk, and I was shaking, and I was hurting. And I had to do my little NyQuil deal, and I was out of NyQuil, and it was too far to get to Greenville or Indianola, and I thought about that little place up there. Hell, I ain't been there in 2 years, and I thought, you know, that old woman don't work up there. She never even wrecked. She's probably gone by now. I probably eased my truck right on around that little store there, not but about half a mile from my house. Probably make it that far. I think I'll go in there. So I did. I went up there, and I got out the truck, walked up there, cracked the door of that place, and as soon as I cracked the door, she screamed all through the store, here come the NyQuil man! Oh, jeez. Oh. Oh, God. Anyway, I tried so hard to make the NyQuil work, but I couldn't do nothing with it. It didn't work. Like many tries I had at getting sober, nothing was working. And so one night, before I went home, I had this friend that I drank with sometimes, and he was, if not worse an alcoholic with me, at least as bad an alcoholic with me. And if I told my wife I was just going to this guy's house or going to be with him, she's mad already because she knows what's fixing to happen. So anyway, I happened to drive by his house, and I saw my friend's truck's over there. And I stopped. I said, I think I'll stop in there and go over there and see what's going on. They're probably drinking. And I think I might even go in there and have me a little drink. I mean, I was already drunk. I don't really know I needed a little drink. But when I got in there, there was several of my friends in there. And this one guy, we all sitting around, about 10 of them sitting around a table. They were all talking, having fun. Telephone was right on the table, right in front of everybody. And my friend Rick, he picked up the phone. He said, I need to check in with my wife. And he called his wife. He said, hey, honey. You want me to go by the store? Oh, sure, I'll get you some, whatever you need, darling. I'll be right on home. It won't be long. And I thought to myself, you know, Ann had told me she wished I'd call her sometime, tell me where I was, what was going on. I saw how well that went. So I picked up the phone. I dialed my wife, and I said, hey, darling, I'm over at Peyton's house. She said, don't you come home, you drunk SOB. Except she didn't say SOB. And hung up my face, and a dial tone's gone off on the phone here. But I'm around a lot of people. I continued the conversation. I said, I love you too, darling. Oh, and don't keep supper on either, please. I'll be right on. Yeah, okay. Well, I know what's going on. I'm listening to a dial tone in my ear. That's what's going on. So I ended up riding around that night in my truck and listening to some old sad country station. Guy, if you're a guy like me, it doesn't take very much under these circumstances to start crying. So that's what I was doing, riding around crying, and I decided, you know, I think I'm going to go home and talk this thing out. So I went on home, and I knocked on the door, and I knocked on the door. The door was locked tight. And I waited and waited. Finally, Ann comes to the door. She said, what do you want? I said, I really, really need to talk to you. It's something I got to tell you, and I got to talk to you. She said, no, go on, Ralph. I told you, I want you to come home drunk. I said, well, I'm crying, she's kind of feeling for me just a little, I guess. And I said, just let me tell you this one thing, and I'll get out of here. I won't stay and cause any disturbance or anything. So she reluctantly opened up the door. And I walked in, and she said, what is it? I said, well, I've been seeing this doctor. And I've got leukemia. I got about six months, a year to live. She said, oh, my God. Start crying. I feel a little bit better at this point. So we had these really close friends, our next door neighbors. They were good friends. So we called them up and told them about it, too. So they were all crying. Anne's crying. She said, would y'all like a drink? And they said, yeah, I think we would like a drink. They gave me a drink, too. Hell, I'm back home drinking again. I mean, what the hell? I'm going to die anyway, So the biggest problem with that thing is, I'd like to ask y'all one thing. Have y'all ever felt the feeling of remorse? I had it bad. I felt so bad about that. But, there was another thing going on. I got to figure out some kind of way I'm going to live. Because I think, how am I going to get out of this one? And so I finally came up with some idea after a few weeks that I'd gone to the doctor and I had a vitamin deficiency, and it's going to be okay. And The crazy thing is, this friend of ours worked at this agricultural place out near where I live, where a lot of scientists are and everything. And he had ended up moving away, and I don't know how many years it was later. It may have been 8-10 years later. I went in the grocery store one day, and a guy was in there that worked out there with him. I didn't really know him that well. He said, "Aren't you Ralph McGee?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Man, I heard you had leukemia. How are you doing?" I said, "Oh, well, I got over that." But anyway, these are the kind of things that were going on with me. And I was having a time trying to stay sober. And my wife had finally decided that she'd had enough. And she said, "She's moving out. She ain't coming home. Don't call her. She's taking the kid. She's gone." And I tried as hard as I could. I mean, she'd done this before, you know. But this time, every time I try to call her, she's refusing to come home. And, you know, I got a child. You know, I don't want them to raise my child. I tried as hard as I could try to stay sober. I managed, I don't know how I did it, but some kind of way I was able to stay sober a couple of weeks. And I called her, I was sober, and I begged her. And she said, "I'll come home on one condition. You call Big Richard, and you start going to AA." Well, Big Richard was this great big guy. He was my daddy's cousin, that's how I knew him, and I had known that he had some sobriety, I didn't know how much. And so he was sort of the AA in town. And people would call him, a lot of people had a problem, they just knew about him, they'd call him and he'd start taking them meetings. And so I told her I'd do that. I mean, I had to do something. Of course, she comes home. Brings the kid home, sitting there, and we're trying to talk it out. And she said, "You know, it was never your drinking that bothered me. It's your getting drunk." Well, you know, if an alcoholic, not my drinking that bothers me. A light bulb goes on in my head. She's telling me I can go get me a drink of beer or something. So I did. Went back in the refrigerator, got a beer, came back, and started drinking in front of her. She ain't even unpacked her suitcase yet. And as it goes, I got drunk again that night, as expected. And the next day, she didn't leave. The next day, she was madder than hell. And she said, "Did you call Big Richard?" I said, "No, I didn't call him." She dialed up his number and stuck the phone in my ear. She said, "Talk to him." And I said, on the other phone, I said, "Hello." "Well, boy, you really done it this time, ain't you?" I said, "Yeah, Richard, I'm in a world of trouble. You want me to come talk to you?" I said, "I think you better, Richard. I got to do something." So, Richard's going to come over, and he's going to talk to me. And I mean, the way I'm drinking, I'm in so much denial about my drinking. I did not think I was an alcoholic. I knew I drank all the time. I knew I got drunk all the time. I knew it was hard for me to get sober. I thought, oh man, anybody that had a daddy die in a car wreck, anybody that had all the problems I had, the financial problems I got now with all the debt on the farm, and my girlfriend drunk me a long time ago, you know, and all the problems that you got, anybody would drink under these circumstances. And that's why I drink. That's why I'm having a hard time. It's not because I'm an alcoholic. And I mean, you know, not that I never wondered the thought. I mean, after all, my mother and father are both alcoholic. Not that I didn't wonder if I was an alcoholic. And I heard a speaker talk one time, John A. from California. He talked one time, and he said, I want to tell y'all something. Only an alcoholic wonders if he's an alcoholic. And my life is, here I am, it's 3:00 in the morning. I can't sleep anymore. I'm shaking so bad. I'm about to explode. My body's going to explode. I'm not drinking to get high anymore. I'm drinking to get normal. I'm not trying to get a buzz. I'm just trying to get back to square one. I'm shaking. I'm looking in the mirror. I'm trying to get a pint of vodka to stay down. It's not staying down. Every time I take a drink, it comes back up. I'd sit in there for 30 minutes till the vodka's gone. I ain't got any of it to stay down. My face is red. My eyes are watering. The water comes out of my nose. I look in the mirror and I say, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. You know, I never had figured out what the problem was by knowing whether I was an alcoholic. I mean, my dog knew I was an alcoholic. You know, everybody that ever knew me knew I was an alcoholic. But I deny saying I'm an alcoholic. So Richard comes over. And he comes over there, and we get on the porch there, and we talk a minute. And all I remember about him out there talking is my wife's face was at the window looking, wanting to know everything we said. I know you Al-Anons don't do that kind of stuff. But she's trying to hear everything we're saying out there. And one thing I remember him saying was, after he looked at me and talked to me in a minute, he said, Ralph, I'm going to tell you something. He said, you're an alcoholic. And this guy, 6'5", 6'6", weighs about 300 pounds, said he's been sober 18 years. I didn't try to argue with him. But, he said, but there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of peace. You come going, start letting me take you to AA. You're going to find the answers you've been looking for. I can help you. He said, just give it a try. I'll come get you. He said, we'll go out here and there's a meeting Saturday night. Saturday night? It ain't but Thursday. I won't be sober by then. He said, you're going to have to be just all the way sober. Just don't take a drink. Try not to take a drink. You call me. You call me all day long tomorrow and don't drink. You call me. And I don't care how many times, we're going to try to make that meeting Saturday night. Well, the meeting Saturday night was an open meeting. And I thought, well, I mean, think about it, really. I do qualify as an Al-Anon. I don't have to really be an alcoholic to go. And anyway, so sure enough, Saturday night, meeting's in Greenville. Richard comes all the way over to where I live to pick me up and take me to Greenville to the meeting, because I'm too weak to drive, you know. And I go in there, and there's a speaker there. I don't remember anything he said. I can't remember anything about what he said. All I remember is I went to a meeting. That was a big deal. I went to a meeting. And so that Monday night was a closed meeting. And that was up at our church, where I grew up in the church. Same one I've been in all my life. And Saturday, Sunday, all the way to Monday, my heart was pounding. I got to go to this meeting. I got to go to this meeting. It's a closed meeting. I didn't know what a meeting was. And other than that open meeting I'd gone to. And I would have rather faced a panther in the woods than to walk in the doors of that meeting. But I went in there. Big Richard had me. And when I got there, there was about 12 people in that room. And I don't know to this day if they did it for me, or was it the way they did it. As soon as I opened up and walked in there, every one of those people were smiling. They walked up to me and they put their arms around me and said, we're glad you're here. I don't know about y'all folks, it's been a long time since anybody put their arms around me and said they were glad I was here. And that was one thing I remembered about that meeting. And the other thing I remember about that meeting was this lady over here started talking. She said, my name's Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. She talked a little bit, passed it on. My name's Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. The light goes off in my head. They expect me to say that? And I don't know what happened that night. For whatever reason, they may have planned it this way. It never got to me. And so I mean, my father's in AA and everything. This big Richard carried me to the meeting. I didn't know nothing about AA. I thought Big Richard had founded AA. I thought he was the national president of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew him. He was my friend, Big Richard. So I said to him, I said, Richard, you know, in the meetings in there where they go around and they say the name, they say the alcoholic. He said, yeah. He said, is there any way you could have that changed? He said, yeah, I'll get it changed for you. I said, I'll keep coming back then. So the bad thing was about my drinking and going, it was that my going to AA was that I really had not quit drinking. And I did stay sober some days, but I might go a week and then I'd take a drink and then I'd go to AA and then I'd take another drink, I'd go to AA and, you know, I'd try this thing back and forth, going maybe 2 weeks and I'd take a drink, go to another meeting, you know. They started giving out these chips, one day of chips. I bet I had a sack full of one day chips. And this kind of thing went on for a while. Another thing was that, I mean, it's one of my daily rituals now was, I think I got about a month, maybe a couple of months, I hadn't had anything to drink, but I really wasn't really sober. I still carried around these little funny cigarettes you smoke, and I was still drinking that NyQuil cough medicine, a little bit. And so one of my daily rituals was to go to work. I put my little funny cigarettes on the towel there on the bed, and then I put the NyQuil in there, and I put my big book in there, wrap it all up. I'm going to work. And I'll go down to this little house in the woods, this little private place we got back there, and I'm going to make me some coffee, and I'm going to smoke me one of those little funny cigarettes, and I'm going to read the big book. The guy came in one day, and I was in there, and he said, what are you doing, man? And man, I'm reading the big book. There's some heavy stuff in that book. I said, I'm really sober, aren't I? So I kept going to AA and I kept getting a little bit better and a little bit better. I was getting to wean off of this other stuff. And I got 3 months of sobriety. And this was right around Christmas time, and my brother's birthday is on Christmas Day. So they decided they were going to give him a little birthday party. He had a real birthday party, like on the 22nd. And I was in there. My wife was in the shower. We were going down to this party. I had about 3 months of sobriety. And this insurance agency comes over, and he gives me a bottle of whiskey for Christmas, like they do for doing business with them or something. And actually, this was a bottle of tequila. It had all these colored things on it, and the bottle and everything. So I took it back there, and I was in the shower, and I said, I wonder what that stuff smelled like. And I popped the top, and I went to smelling it, and what a fool. I mean, for whatever reason, who knows why, I took a great big slug of that tequila. And all I felt was sickness. There was no warm glow. There was no good feeling. The only feeling I had was I let everybody down again. So I went on to this party and knew the bartender there, and he slipped me a couple of things. Of course, I was running into people that knew I was an AA. I'm so proud of you, so proud of you. And I'm slipping around there drinking a little shot of gin every now and then, walking around, stumbling around with a coffee cup. But I made it home that night. And I don't know what happens to you when it's 12 o'clock at night. I'm wanting to go out. Well, where are you going? I can't drive. I'm drunk. My wife's so mad at me, so disappointed. She starts calling Big Richard, trying to get him on the phone. Please, please get him on the phone. Big Richard talks to me and convinces me not to drive and not to leave. And I did. I stayed home. And that was on December 22nd. And that is the last drink I ever took. And on December 23rd, 1979, that's my sobriety day. And the next Monday night was a closed meeting. And I went in that meeting that night, and I started saying it again. My name's Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. They got to me, and I don't know why. I said, my name is Ralph. I'm an alcoholic. It was like I surrendered things that had been on me, or a monkey riding on my back since I was in the ninth grade. I'd carried this denial of being an alcoholic, wonder if I'm an alcoholic, not to say that I'm an alcoholic. I've been taking that around for a long time. And I finally said it, my name is Ralph and I'm an alcoholic. And it was a peaceful feeling. It sounds so trivial today. We all say it. But that was a huge for me. And I started going to meetings. I started trying to work these steps. I quit doing all that other funny stuff I was doing. I was really sober. And I wasn't feeling too good, but I was going. And I asked somebody in a meeting, I said, you know, what are you doing this program of? Get better. You know, what do you do? He said, why don't you do something, Ralph? Why don't you just do something? I said, do something? What do you mean do something? He said, we all come over from Greenville. Why don't you come in there and start making the coffee for the meeting? I thought about that. I said, yeah, I'll do that. I'll make the coffee tomorrow night for the meeting. I'd be glad to. Well, for the next 8 years, I was making coffee. I was cleaning up the room. I'm getting everything ready. But you know what? I was getting better. It's keeping me sober. So, Big Richard, he was a great inspiration to me. A great inspiration. He came to get me from his hometown, come to my hometown, take me back to his hometown to the meeting, bring me back to my house. He would do anything for me, and he helped me in those early days, staying sober, and I called him. I wish I had a nickel for every time I ever called Big Richard. And God bless him. He's gone today, but he probably saved my life. And my Aunt Cor Louise, Dom's talking about her. In 1979, she moved back from the General Service Office in New York, where she was working for, you know, she had worked for Bill Wilson. And she's the only person I ever knew that even knew Bill Wilson. And she moved back to our hometown. And I'm sober. She moved back in 1980. I got sober in 79. So I felt like she moved back there. It was God sent her there. And God knows she helped me so much with this program, the spiritual part of this program. She was a great, great inspiration to me. And I remember one time, my mother, after my father died, she remarried. And when they were moving from our old house, she gave me a bunch of stuff that came out of the attic or came off the bookshelves or whatever. And I was looking through some of it. She gave me a bunch of books, really. And one of them was an AA book. And I started kind of flipping through it, and I realized that was my father's AA book. And a note fell out of this book. And I picked it up, and I read it. And it was some kind of thing my daddy, I don't know if he was preparing for a talk or what, it was in his handwriting. And it said, faith is accepting what God offers us. Patience, forgiveness, and love. It is ours just for the asking. And I thought, boy, that is a great definition for faith. Accepting what God offers us. And I thought, man, I could use that and try to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And accept what He gives me. accept what God offers me. Because, look, folks, I've been in AA a little while there, and I was sober. I still had trouble at home. My wife wasn't all happy about everything in the world. I had a world of financial problems. The land was all tied up in debt. I had children problems. There was a world of problems still on me. And I wanted to not just turn my drinking over. But maybe I could turn these other things over, my whole life over to the care of God and accept what God offers me. And I started on this mission to accept what God offers me. And I'd have to do it on a daily basis. Just like we get sober one day at a time. I couldn't just turn it all over and it's gone. I had to turn it over every day. And I still had this lack of confidence in myself. Still had this lack, well, maybe not so much of self-esteem, but always had this lack of confidence in myself. And this is something Cole Louise told me one time. This is one of the things that I loved her for telling me these little things. She told me this one time, and I mean, I'd like to share it with you. It meant so much to me. I told her one time, I said, Cole Louise, I still don't have any confidence in myself. I've been sober in AA. I've been working the steps. I just don't have any confidence in myself. I've been sober 3 years. She said, Ralph, you don't have to have any confidence in yourself. All you have to have is confidence in God. Oh, I tell you, so simple, so powerful, such a thing that turned the rusty screws up here. Been stuck for so long. Where I'm running the show all the time, I got to run the show. I got to fix it. I got to fix it. If I don't fix it, it's not going to work. I'm going to try to accept what God offers me. And so I begin this. I begin trying to turn my will and life over the care of God. And I'm now on this spiritual journey, trying to give my life to Him. And, you know, when I think back on all the miracles that happened to me, all the miracles, it's unbelievable. My life was a ball of thread that was so intertwined, no one could have fixed any of my problems. They were too big, and I owed too much money for one of them. I was always had this great fear of losing the land. And I would be praying all the time, God, please let us keep the land. The federal land bank's howling down on us because we owe them too much money. And God, please let me keep it. And one day I really realized I thought it was a big chance we could lose it. So I got on my hands and knees and I prayed to God, please let us keep it. And God told me these words, no. And we had to sell the land. And we sold this land to this man that lived in Germany. And this man has turned out to be one of the greatest blessings of my life. He's the richest man I ever knew. He comes to see me. He treats me like a son. He comes to see me every year. I go to Germany to see him. My wife and I have been over there several times over the years to visit he and his wife. They come here every year to visit us. He gives me the fairest, more than fair rent. He's letting me farm that land, wants me to farm it forever. He's got it in a trust now to where I'll always have it to farm. The way I was going to fight it. I'm going to fight that land bank. I'm going to work it out. I'm going to do it. I'm going to fight them, trying to see if some kind of way I can keep the land. But I had to accept what God offered me. And it was way better than anything I could have ever conjured up. I mean, you know, this is a blessing. I said another prayer one time. I said, God, please, please, please don't make me go to AA. Please, God, please don't let me be an alcoholic. Well, thank God he said no to that one too. And I've had some miracles in my life like that, and lots of others. And many of you, I know you've had miracles in your life. And if you're new in this program, please believe me. Keep coming. Keep coming back, because God will perform a miracle in your life too. And you know, I hope I never forget to be grateful. But God's gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will always be grateful to you for saving my life. Thank you.